Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. And in today's episode, I am going to venture on over to Hillsdale County and dig through some history provided by the Hillsdale County Historical Society and talk about some of the early industry in Hillsdale County and some of this manufacturing businesses that once existed in the county. And there's some very fascinating stories connected with that. So come along and join me. So all the information I'm going to be referring to today are from articles that are available online at the HillsdaleHistoricalSociety.org. And there's a wonderful collection of some of the early manufacturing of Hillsdale County. So let's start with some of the transportation-type businesses, and we'll begin with the J.C. Batch Carriage and Wagon Company. Now, we know that this company existed at one time because it showed up in the 1872 Hillsdale Business Directory as an advertisement for carriages and wagons and sleighs and cutters, etc. And they were manufactured in Hillsdale, the city of Hillsdale. And there was also another manufacturing company that was called the J.S. Murray Carriages, Wagons, Sleighs, and Cutters, etc. And they were established over in Litchfield in 1874. And they were a carriage builder, and they were situated on the west of the square on St. Joe Street. Murray also provided blacksmithing services. There was also the Truck and Wagon Works Company that was located on the hill near Cold Springs, and it promised to become one of Hillsdale's best. Unfortunately, a fire destroyed that company in 1913 and destroyed most of the plant for the manufacturing of that. So those are some of the smaller, lesser-known carriage and wagon companies in that area. One of the other buggy companies was the Deal Buggy Company, and there's a lot more known about them. The Jacob J. Deal came to Michigan from New York in 1854. And he came from New York State. And then he went on to Jonesville in 1858, where he opened a blacksmith shop. Deal did all kinds of custom work until about 1865, and then he sold the shop and erected two small buildings on West Street, where he started building wagons and buggies. He also hired over a dozen men to help him with repairs as well as new work. And although numerous buggy shops existed throughout the county, the Deal plant seemed to thrive where others had failed. The company turned out hundreds of carts, wagons, carriages, and sleighs, necessitating laying extra railroad track next to the Deal building. And due to the fine quality of the workmanship and a significant amount of paint, the norm of the day, a few of these products remain in pristine condition to this day, which I'll share with you here in a few minutes. Jacob Deal had one surviving son, George, who became his father's partner in 1891, and the business was then renamed J.J. Deal and Son. George became interested in horseless carriages, specifically delivery trucks, and eventually Deal began to assemble what they called auto buggies, which developed into the Deal Automobile in 1908. Unfortunately, George died later that year. For five more years, the company was run by Omar Dickinson. After that, the auto buggy was no longer produced, and the company went out of business in 1915. Only two of the Deal autos are known to still exist today. One of them is at Harrah's Casino in Las Vegas, but was sold to a private collector when Harrah's was redecorated. And the other sits in the front display window of the Jonesville City Building at East Chicago and Evans Street in Jonesville. So you should check that out if you are interested in seeing one of these rare automobiles that were manufactured right there in Hillsdale County for a very short time. One of the other manufacturing businesses that had quite a history in Hillsdale County was the Acme Chair Company. If you've ever been wanting to plan a picnic supper and need tables and chairs for that outdoor picnic, or organizing an outdoor wedding, or any kind of an event where people are going to be sitting outdoors, probably need folding chairs. If you ever tailgated, you probably wanted a few of those in your vehicle. But the availability of folding chairs back in the 1800s was not really as it is today. I mean, you can find and buy folding chairs today pretty much at any kind of department store or even online. But when you're looking for folding chairs and tables back in the 1800s, there weren't that many companies that were doing this. So there was a man by the name of C.D. Schermerhorn who lived between 1846 and 1913, and he was from Redding, Michigan, over in Hillsdale County. Now, the C.D. in his name stood for Charles Darwin, but he was known around Reading as C.D., and he was a guy with a vision. He was the youngest of seven children of John and Sarah Smith Schermerhorn. C.D. helped his father farm for 5 years, and he also worked as a clerk in the Ransom Dry Goods Store. His clerking career lasted 8 years, and the last three, he was the owner of the store of his own. That move towards ownership spoke to C.D.'s assertiveness and forward thinking. In 1887, he and his brother William, who was 22 years old, bought the Colby Ringer and Washing Machine Company, which made folding chairs as a sideline. And the Colby Company became Schermerhorn Brothers and specialized in lumber and building supplies. Now, William was the older brother, and he was 63 years old when he and C.D. went into business together. And their partnership only lasted a few months until C.D. bought out his brother's shares of the company. Now, exactly why the partnership ended is only speculated. It may have been because William was suffering from ill health during that time. But regardless, William's departure freed C.D. up to follow what he thought was a more profitable path for the company, and he renamed the company the Acme Chair Company. And he developed unique and unrivaled designs of all types of portable and folding chairs. In fact, he made over 55 different types of these chairs. Included were five styles of folding lawn seats, in addition to several styles of folding tables. Known from the beginning as the Big Factory in Reading, by 1911, the company had doubled in size and was the largest industry in that small community. It employed 85 men, and its products were shipped all over the United States. Now, sadly, a fire burned the wood factory to the ground shortly after, which was a huge catastrophe for the city, but it was rebuilt using brick with firewalls built in for safety, and it was at the cost of $100,000, which was a tremendous amount of money at that time. But what was amazing was the fact that the money was partially raised by the sale of bonds to members of the Reading community. And then in 1945, the new factory partially burned again, and the rebuilding at that time added an office, and which had been previously located in a house across the street, and it also added a new section to the building. Now, after C.D.'s death, his children, George and Elizabeth, inherited the Acme Chair Company. George was originally brought into the factory in 1909 as an associate so that he could learn the business. After his father died in 1913, George became the president and general manager. In addition, he was the president of the local bank in Reading, and the position that C.D.'s daughter held, Elizabeth, is kind of an unknown commodity in the annals of history. She was involved with the company, and the employees expressed a positive attitude towards her, but her actual role in the company is really not known today. In a book, A History of Reading Village and Township, which spans 1835 to 1911, it stated that she was a modest and unassuming woman, respected for her business acumen and her ability to protect her interest in the company. However, Lizzie was also a teacher for many years. Lizzie lived from 1874 until 1965. Her last years in the beautiful Schermerhorn home in Reading is where she spent her days. Now, reportedly, she and a woman who acted as a helper and companion lived in very few of the many rooms in that building. Today, that family home is the George White Funeral Home in Reading, and it still has much of the original decorative woodwork in it. So that's some of the history of the Acme Chair Company. Now, next, we're going to take a look at the Pinkham and Wright Ford dealership. On October 3rd, 1899, the first horseless carriage passed through Hillsdale to the amazement of the locals. In the early 1900s, acquiring a new automobile was literally front page news. The only rule of the road was the vague assumption from horse and buggy days that you stayed on the right. Speaking from observation, the newspaper cautioned the autoists that accidents to pedestrians and people in carriages are very possible. Pinkham and Wright set up shop originally on Broad Street. There they employed men to assemble Ford autos that were shipped in component parts. In various automobile businesses, the men worked in teams, sometimes challenging other teams to see who could get their car up and running the fastest. So that's kind of a fascinating lost chapter in history, that the early automobile dealers received the vehicles in parts and they had to assemble them before they could even make them available to the public. Kind of interesting how times have changed. When Pinkham and Wright first proposed to the city council that they build a larger place on McCollum Street for their expanding business, they met firm opposition because the area was mainly residential at that time. By September 1919, sentiments had changed and they built a large brick building, which later became Montgomery Ward and then the Midtown Building. The second floor of their business was called a dance hall, but held many public functions. The most memorable, at least to the children involved, was a clinic held by the health department where scores of tonsils were removed with the efficiency of the automobile assembly on the first floor. As cars replaced horses, gasoline stations replaced the line of livery stables on Carlton Road and west of Broad Street. Along Gasoline Alley were filling stations like Liard's Mobile, High Speed Station, and Shell Oil, as well as stations for Sunoco, Standard, and High Flash. It was a new era for transportation moving forward. And that's another thing about some of the early history of the industries. As the automobile industry came into being, the other types of industries like livery stables and carriage factories disappeared into the annals of yesteryear because they became no longer the main thing that was needed. Livery stables were a big part of most every community in Southwest Michigan, as well as carriage manufacturers and blacksmiths. And all of these professions kind of went by the wayside with the introduction of the automobile or horseless carriage, as it was called in the early models. So it's kind of an interesting transition that a lot of communities observed during the early 1900s, which makes it a very fascinating period because at the same time you have horses and buggies passing the roadways with automobiles sharing the same lanes. It must have been a point where it reached that 50-50 point where there was half and half on the road, and then eventually the horse and buggies fell more by the wayside. Kind of an interesting period of time to look at in the field of transportation in Southwest Michigan, as well as the entire United States, really. Another industry that was in that county was the Worthington and Alger Company, and it was a fur business. And there's a little bit of information available here on it. The abandoned factory on Carlton Road between Union and Oak Streets once housed a thriving fur business. The Worthing and Alger Company tanned skins and created garments from animals they furnished, as well as from skins supplied by the customer. Almost any mammal could be turned into a coat, hat, muff, collar, cuffs, rug, or robe. Using the fur of wild creatures and domestic farm animals isn't unusual. The use of cat and dog skins, however, seems grisly. One Book of Furs for Ladies and Gentlemen, published by Worthing and Alger's, showed a woman modeling an actual dog skin set of muff and stole, and advertising that the customer would furnish two collie dog skins, and we do the rest for only $10. Ouch, that doesn't sound like fun. Not for the collie, and certainly kind of goes against the grain with me on being a profound dog lover. But hey, cover your ears, dogs. All right, my dogs are in the room and they're looking at me like, what did you just say? Anyways, fur garments from Worthing and Alger were sold across the United States, as well as in many villages in Hillsdale County. With hides supplied by the customer at half the price of those furnished by Worthing and Alger. Putting aside our squeamishness in turning family pets into garments, we can admire the early recycling efforts of our ancestors as they created a second use for animals that had died on their farms or in their homes. Interesting take on it, I suppose. Let's take a look at another industry. The early hardware store in Hillsdale was more of a general store for the male population. In the early days, there were numerous with a similar look. It seemed a requisite that the floors be worn hardwood with nail bins lining the walls and the center of the floor and a large scale in the middle, since nothing was prepackaged in those days. Now, I have still encountered some old hardware stores that have been around a very long time that still operate that way, and I just love it. It just gives you that sense of walking back in time. I remember encountering those in Georgia, and if anybody went into Lakeview Hardware or even the Mix Hardware when before the building burned down here in Battle Creek and was rebuilt and remodernized, they had a lot of those old characteristics when you went into those stores. Now, Lakeview Hardware is no longer there. They sold out a couple years ago, and their building is being turned into a flower shop these days. But the older men in would come out in the back door and hang around the counter, smoking and joking at these hardware stores. A man would have his favorite hardware store, although such businesses often spread around. When indoor plumbing, new furnaces, and ductwork were needed, it was the hardware store that provided not only the supplies, but the workmen to do the job. Remodeling and upgrading your home became local news. One of the best examples is shown in this December 13th, 1909 Hillsdale Daily Standard Herald, in which new homes and specific remodels were listed for the previous year, including exactly what was done and the total cost. Keeping up with the neighbors and their improvements had literally become front page news, and you depended on your favorite hardware store to help you reach that goal. When the Gelsers opened their first store in North Howell, it followed the model of other hardware stores and was more of a general store. Like other early hardware stores, it handled farm implements and later sold sporting goods. There was even a toy department, which was one of the particular interests to children at Christmas time. The Gelsers family opened the hardware store bearing the name in the store that was originally George Smith Hillsdale Hardware, farther south on Howell Street. In the middle of the block across Howell Street from the county courthouse, who could forget Carl Katzenmeyer standing in the doorway of Katzenmeyer Hardware, always with a cigar in his mouth. This building also held a previous hardware store, that of McDermott and Gardner, and then it became just Gardner. Harry Katzenmeyer, Carl's father, bought out George Gardner, and the hardware store continued until the 1970s when Carl passed away. The building was then purchased by the Newtons, and the fabrics and notions and patterns in their store, and material things replaced the nut bolts and lawnmowers of the hardware store. So today, the building houses the Blossom Shop. So very fascinating history of some of the early hardware stores, a couple of interesting anecdotes about some of the early owners, and some great photos on the Hillsdale Historical Society website from a lot of these businesses so far to look at and venture through. Another interesting business was the Hillsdale Bottling Works. Edward Jackson incorporated the Hillsdale Bottling Works in 1919 in the gutted and reconfigured building at 66 North Street. Between then and 1934, when Bill Knott bought it for cash in the Great Depression, Ford Foote, then president of the Hillsdale County Bank, owned it. Bill Knott's entry into the business world included another venture in 1934 when he married Marion Perkins. She became the vice president of the business and also presented him with two children. Prior to owning his business, Bill had worked for his older brother's dairy. Because of the Depression, many people were unable to pay their milk bills, so Bill began accepting diamonds as payment. He kept these unmounted stones knotted up in a corner of his handkerchief. On the very day that President Franklin Roosevelt declared a bank holiday, really a closing, in March of 1933, Bill walked into a jewelry store in Detroit, unraveled his unorthodox but very valuable pack, and negotiated for alternative stones and a mounting, and designed the rings that Marion wore the rest of her life. The Hillsdale Bottling Works manufactured ice cream and all kinds of flavors of soft drinks, including Coca-Cola, for which it held a franchise. Several trucks distributed its products over the surrounding counties, and the business increased 500% during 1935, an original signal that the worst of the Depression was in the past. Bill changed the ice cream name from Bon Ton to Very Fine after World War II with its polio scare. Bill converted the old family 41 Ford convertible into an ice cream truck to sell clown ice cream bars around town to the children who were restricted in their homes during the summer for health reasons. Bill also used the ice cream business to give his children, Fred and Helen, the chance to be independent. He gave them an ice cream stand to take to the various summer county fairs in Michigan so they could pay for their own college educations. While Marion taught at Mock School in the Hillsdale Community Schools, Bill ran the Hillsdale Bottling Works for about 25 years. Some of the bottles made in the plant, including a nifty seltzer bottle, now reside at the Will Carlton Poorhouse, along with the milk can and wooden crates. So that's kind of an interesting history of the Hillsdale Bottling Company, which had an impact in that community for many, many years. So there's a lot of other interesting industries that happened in Hillsdale County, and I'll probably do another episode at a later date, maybe going into some of the hotels and insurance companies and whatnot that happened during those years. But just thought I'd share with you some of these stories of the early industry. There's a lot of fascinating tales in this collection, and it's available on the Hillsdale Historical Society website, which I'll put a link to in the show note descriptions. But that's going to conclude today's episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing some of the tales of the early manufacturing businesses and other types of businesses that existed in Hillsdale County in the very early days, even leading back to the 1800s. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to leave a rating or review on whatever app that you are listening on out there. And if you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me at michaeldelaware.com. I am always happy to hear from my listeners. You can also go on that website and pre-order a copy of my new book, Victorian Southwest Michigan True Crime, and I will send you a signed copy when the book's is finally released, which is going to be very soon, in a few weeks actually. I'll probably have some of my shipment in, at least I'm hoping for that. That being said, until next time when we take another journey into yesterday and explore even more fascinating tales from Southwest Michigan's past. Thank you for listening.